clumsy craft, but with experienced helmsmen they could be more or less controlled. The six canoes were round-bottomed dugouts hewn from cottonwood trees, each with three paddlers. They were more difficult to maneuver and much more likely to ship water, especially when rounding a point into the wind. To overcome the wind, the men often got out and tugged the craft along, using elk-skin ropes and one hemp line per boat. Or they could use setting poles to propel the pirogues and canoes forward. Best of all were the times when the wind was behind them. Then the men could raise their square sails and scoot along at a breathtaking 3 miles an hour. Worst of all were the times when there was a strong headwind. This could force the party to stay in camp for an entire day. Of course, the captains didn't waste the enforced layover. Lewis and Clark supervised drying damp articles, repairing the fleet, making moccasins and clothing, adding to the meat supply, writing in their journals, making observations. During the first 4 days, the expedition covered 93 miles to the mouth of the Little Missouri. In the process, it traversed the many miles long curve of the river called the Great Bend. That meant that, for the first time since Lewis left the mouth of the Kansas River in July 1804, he was headed nearly straight west instead of northwest or even straight north. His journal entries were lyrical. On April 15th, 8 days out of Fort Mandan, the expedition passed the farthest point upstream on the Missouri known by Lewis to have been reached by white men. The previous voyagers were two French trappers, one of them now a member of the expedition, Private Baptiste Lepage. Lewis was now stepping into the unknown. For all he had heard from the Hidatsas about what lay ahead, for all that he knew the distance to his destination, as the crow flies, he was as close to entering a completely unknown territory, nearly a half continent wide, as any explorer ever was. His April 7th half-humorous comparison of his fleet to those of Columbus and Cook was on the mark. He was entering a heart of darkness. Deserts, mountains, great cataracts, warlike Indian tribes, he could not imagine them because no American had ever seen them. But far from causing apprehension or depression, the prospect brought out his fullest talents. He knew that from now on until he reached the Pacific and returned, he would be making history. He was exactly what Jefferson wanted him to be, optimistic, prudent, alert to all that was new about him, and able to describe the flora and fauna, the native inhabitants, and the skies above with scientific measurement. His health was excellent. His ambition was boundless. His determination was complete. He could not, would not, contemplate failure. Lewis had come to a point that he had longed for, worked for, dreamed of all of his life. He was ready, intensely alive. Every nerve ending was sensitive to the slightest change, whether what the eye saw or the skin felt or the ears heard or the tongue tasted or the fingers touched. He had an endearing sense of wonder and awe at the marvels of nature that made him the nearly perfect man to be the first to describe the glories of the American West. He turned his face west. He would not turn it around until he reached the Pacific Ocean. He stepped forward into paradise. Not quite paradise, although one would hardly know it from Lewis's descriptions, which were accurate enough but always given a positive slant. Overall, Lewis was enchanted by the plains. May 5th. The country is, as yesterday, beautiful in the extreme. He did not mention the indications of average yearly rainfall, which was less than 10 inches. He did mention one apparent result in his entry of April 10th. The country on both sides of the Missouri from the tops of the river hills is one continued level, fertile plain as far as the eye can reach, in which there is not even a solitary tree or shrub to be seen. Most American pioneers believed that hardwood forests were a sign of good soil and would have regarded the treeless plains as unsuitable to agriculture, but Lewis had an easy, and so far as it went, accurate, explanation for the lack of trees. No trees could get started because the Indians burned the prairie each spring. The soil was fertile, as evidenced by the grass. The plains grew luxuriant grass, enough to feed an uncountable number of animals. This really was paradise for such creatures as the deer, elk, buffalo, sheep, pronghorns, and other grass-eating animals, and for the beaver who lived off the bark of the cottonwood trees, and for the coyote, fox, wolves, and bears who lived off the hoofed animals, and for the human hunters who declared war on the predators and lived off their prey. Lewis exclaimed at the magnificence of it all. April 17th. We saw immense quantities of game in every direction around us as we passed up the river, consisting of herds of buffalo, elk, and antelopes with some deer and wolves. April 21st. We saw immense herds of buffalo, elk, deer, and antelopes. April 22nd. I ascended to the top of the Cut Bluff this morning, from whence I had a most delightful view of the country, the whole of which, except the valley formed by the Missouri, is void of timber or underbrush, exposing to the first glance of the spectator immense herds of buffalo, elk, deer, and antelopes, feeding in one common and boundless pasture. Walking on shore this evening, I met with a buffalo calf which attached itself to me and continued to follow close at my heels until I embarked and left it. April 27th. Although game is very abundant and gentle, we only kill as much as is necessary for food. I believe that two good hunters could conveniently supply a regiment with provisions. The men's labor was again such that each private ate as much as 9 or 10 pounds of meat per day. This meant that when the captains went hunting, to free the hunters to help move the fleet forward, the two of them had to bring in 300 pounds or so of meat. May 6th. It is now only amusement for Captain C. and myself to kill as much meat as the party can consume. I hope it may continue thus through our whole route, but this I do not much expect. On May 5th, Lewis discovered and described the gray wolf. He noted that, unlike its larger relative, the wolf of the Atlantic states, the gray wolf never burrowed, but like the eastern species, howled rather than barked. He marveled at the way the packs wore down buffalo, some wolves pursuing while others rested before taking up the chase in their turn. He noted, "We scarcely see a gang of buffalo without observing a parcel of those faithful shepherds on their skirts in readiness to take care of the maimed and wounded." Of all the animals, the most prized was the beaver. In the immediate range, because the tail of the beaver was one of the most favored delicacies, in the longer term, because if properly prepared, stacked, pressed, and aired once a month or so for moths, the beaver pelt could be gotten back to St. Louis, where it fetched a fair price, then to New York and on to London, where it fetched a fabulous price. So some of the men became en route beaver trappers in the richest beaver country any white man had ever seen. On the third day out, the expedition caught up with 3 French trappers who accompanied it to the Little Missouri. These were the first beaver hunters west of Mandan, according to Lewis, and the beaver these people have already taken is by far the best I have ever seen. He recorded on April 12th that, to his surprise, beaver were seen during the day, proof that they have been but little hunted. On the morning of April 18th, Lewis came upon 2 of his privates engaged in a furious argument. It seemed that 1 beaver had gotten himself caught in 2 traps, belonging to the 2 different men. They were on the verge of blows when Lewis intervened. Beaver was the greatest, most immediately exploitable wealth of the Trans-Mississippi West. Beaver presence in such quality and quantity guaranteed an immediate penetration of Louisiana by American hunters. Lewis was their scout. He characteristically thought of practical uses for other products of the plains. On April 12th, he took some cuttings from a creeping juniper, he called it dwarf juniper, to send to Jefferson and noted, "This plant would make very handsome edgings to the borders and walks of a garden, and it is easily propagated." Advice that innumerable people living in suburbs in the American West ever since have followed. Less successful was his suggestion that buffalo hair would produce a wonderful wool. He claimed it had every appearance of the wool of the sheep, though much finer and more silky and soft. New birds always brought out his passion for detail. On May 1st, Private George Shannon brought in a bird of the plover kind. Lewis took more than 500 words to describe it. Length, weight, wingspan, number of feathers on the tail, and so on, and concluded with observations on its behavior. "It sometimes rests on the water and swims, which I do not recollect having seen the plover do." He named it the Missouri plover. Actually, it was the American avocet, already known to science, but not to Lewis. In April, he discovered and described for the first time the snow goose and the cackling goose. On April 13th, Clark shot a Canadian goose sitting on its nest in the top of a lofty cottonwood. Lewis climbed to inspect the nest and brought back an egg. He noted, "The wild geese frequently build their nests in this manner." That statement later was challenged by 19th-century ornithologists because east of the Mississippi, geese always nested on the ground. But Lewis was right. On the plains, geese often nested in trees as a precaution against predators. So much so that on May 3rd, Lewis was surprised to find a nest among some driftwood, the first he had seen on the ground. He took 3 eggs from it. Another description, later challenged, indeed dismissed as an inexplicable error, was of the grizzly bear. On April 29th, Lewis and a party of hunters brought in their first grizzly. Lewis described it in some detail. Among other observations, he said the testicles were suspended in separate pouches from 2 to 4 inches asunder. He later described the same phenomenon on another bear. No one else has ever seen such a thing, but it is impossible to believe that Lewis made it up. Lewis had seen the first grizzly sign on April 13th. "The men as well as ourselves are anxious to meet with some of these bear," he then recorded. The Indians had given the white men a very formidable account of the strength and ferocity of this animal, but Lewis had discounted the information because the Indians had only bows and arrows, or the indifferent guns with which the traders furnished them. With these, they shoot with such uncertainty and at so short a distance that they frequently miss their aim and fall a sacrifice to the bear. It gave him a bit of pause that the Indians, before attacking a grizzly, went through all the rituals they commonly used before going on a war party. Still, he, Clark, and the men had faith in their long rifles and were eager to challenge the grizzly. On April 29th, Lewis was walking on shore with one man when they spotted 2 grizzlies. Each man fired and hit a bear. One of the wounded beasts escaped, but the other charged Lewis, pursuing him some 80 yards. Fortunately, the bear was badly enough wounded so that Lewis and the private had time to reload. They shot again and killed it. Though not full grown, it weighed 300 pounds. Lewis described it as a much more furious and formidable animal than the black bear of the eastern United States. "It is astonishing to see the wounds they will bear before they can be put to death," he admitted, but he remained cocky. "The Indians may well fear this animal, but in the hands of skillful riflemen, the bears are by no means as formidable or dangerous as the Indians indicated." On May 5th, his cockiness began to fade. Clark and Driard killed a grizzly. Lewis described it as a most tremendous-looking animal, and extremely hard to kill, notwithstanding he had 5 balls through his lungs and 5 others in various parts. He swam more than half the distance across the river to a sandbar, and it was at least 20 minutes before he died. He made the most tremendous roaring from the moment he was shot. The expedition had no equipment with which to weigh the bear. Clark thought he would go 500 pounds. Lewis thought 6. This was their first disagreement. They boiled the oil and put it in a cask. It was as hard as hog's lard. A week later, the party saw a grizzly swim the river. He disappeared before an attack could be made on him. Lewis wrote, "I find that the curiosity of our party is pretty well satisfied with respect to this animal. The size of the beast and the difficulty in killing the bear has staggered the resolution of several of them. Others, however, seem keen for action with the bear. I expect these gentlemen will give us some amusement shortly, as they soon begin now to copulate." The first month of travel into the unknown was splendid all around. Progress was steady, if slower on the average than Lewis had hoped for, and it was generally straight west, directly toward the setting sun. No Indians, hostile or friendly, had been discovered. A good thing, Lewis thought, for he wanted to move as far west and as fast as possible. It is difficult to think of men who sometimes made but a few miles in one day, and never more than 25, as being in a hurry, with no time to spend smoking pipes and explaining themselves to strange tribes, but this was so. Cool or cold nights, mornings when the water froze on the paddles, gave way to warm, pleasant days, except for the wind. There were enough adventures to satisfy everyone. On the fifth day out, Clark went walking while Lewis rowed in the white pirogue. Lewis ordered the fleet to cross to the larboard, south side, in order to avoid a bank that was falling into the river on the starboard side. But although all the canoes saw his signal and crossed, the red pirogue did not. It was being pulled by the tow line. By the time Lewis noticed the failure of communications, it was too late to do anything about it. "I expected to have seen her carried under every instant," he wrote that night, "but it was too late for the men to re-embark, and retreating is more dangerous than proceeding in such cases. They therefore continued their passage up this bank, and much to my satisfaction arrived safe above it." On April 13th, there was another scare. The wind was from the east. Lewis ordered the square sail and the sprit sail hoisted on the white pirogue, which carried her at a pretty good gait. Charbonneau was at the helm. When a sudden squall of wind hit and rocked the boat, Charbonneau panicked. Instead of bringing the craft up into the wind, he laid her broadside to it, which came as close to oversetting the pirogue as it was possible to have missed. Lewis called out orders. "Driard, take the helm and turn her into the wind. You men there, take in the sails." It was done, and the pirogue righted. On April 25th, Lewis entered a wonderland. He decided to walk on ahead, knowing that the Yellowstone River could not be far distant, so that he could make his celestial observations and write a description of the country, while the main party struggled up the Missouri against the wind. He took with him Sergeant Ordway, Driard, Private Joseph Field, and one other man. The party set out at 11 o'clock a.m., accompanied by Lewis's dog, Seaman, who had been out all night but had returned in the morning, to Lewis's delight. They were on the south bank of the Missouri. Shortly after noon, Lewis killed a buffalo calf. One of the men built a fire, and they enjoyed a hearty meal of excellent veal. In the afternoon, Lewis ascended the hills, from whence I had a most pleasing view of the country, particularly of the wide and fertile valleys formed by the Missouri and the Yellowstone rivers, which occasionally, unmasked by the wood on their borders, disclose their meanderings for many miles in their passage through these delightful tracts of country. The animal life added to the romantic quality of the place. The whole face of the country was covered with herds of buffalo, elk, and antelopes. Deer are also abundant, but keep themselves more concealed in the woodland. The buffalo, elk, and antelope are so gentle that we pass near them while feeding, without appearing to excite any alarm among them, and when we attract their attention, they frequently approach us more nearly to discover what we are. That evening, Lewis and his men camped on the Yellowstone, 2 miles south of its junction with the Missouri. In the morning, Lewis sent Private Field up the Yellowstone with instructions to follow it as far as he could and still get back to base camp in a day. Then Lewis set about examining the country. In the bottoms, he found redberry, serviceberry, redwoods, gooseberry, choke cherry, purple currant, and honeysuckle, intermixed with willow, a favorite winter food of the hoofed animals. At 9:41, 9:42, and 9:43 a.m., he measured the altitude of the sun with his sextant and an artificial horizon. He was obtaining his local time, trying to establish the moment of high noon, against which to compare Greenwich time. He could figure out Greenwich time with a set of lunar distance measurements that he could obtain by taking the sextant angle between the moon and the star Altair. What he wanted to fix was the longitude of the junction of the rivers. Toward noon, he heard the discharge of several guns, indicating that Clark and the main party were at the mouth of the Yellowstone. He sent Driard to tell Clark to send a canoe up the Yellowstone to collect the meat his party had killed and prepared. At 6:49, 6:50, and 6:52 p.m., he again measured the sun's altitude. Unfortunately, clouds came up and he was not able to make his nighttime observations. Lewis walked down and joined the main party at the camp on the point of land formed by the junction of the rivers. He found the men all in good health and much pleased at having arrived at this long-wished-for spot, and in order to add in some measure to the general pleasure which seemed to pervade our little community, we ordered a dram to be issued to each person. This soon produced the fiddle, and they spent the evening with much hilarity, singing and dancing, and seemed as perfectly to forget their past toils as they appeared regardless of those to come. Private Field came in to report that the Yellowstone wandered, had a gentle current, many sandbars, and a sand and mud bottom. Clark took measurements. The Missouri at the point of junction was 330 yards wide with a deep channel, whereas the Yellowstone was 297 yards wide and 12 feet deep at its deepest channel. The Hidatsas had told Lewis that the Yellowstone was navigable for pirogues and canoes nearly to its source in the Rocky Mountains, at today's Yellowstone National Park, and that at one point it passed within less than a half day's march of a navigable part of the Missouri. They also said that the sources of the Yellowstone were adjacent to those of the Missouri, Platte, and Columbia rivers. They were right about the Missouri and Columbia, which do have their ultimate sources in the Yellowstone Plateau, but wrong about the Platte, which rises in the Colorado and Wyoming Rockies. The captains apparently never gave it a thought, but had they listened more closely to the Indians, and had Jefferson's instructions not been so contradictory, he wanted the explorers to follow the Missouri to its source, but he also wanted them to follow the shortest route across the continent. The president's assumption that these were one and the same was badly wrong. They might have abandoned the Missouri and ascended the Yellowstone. At today's Livingston, Montana, where the Yellowstone makes a sharp bend from a northerly to an easterly flow, or from west to south going upstream, the party could have abandoned the river and continued west to cross the Continental Divide over a relatively low pass, today's Bozeman Pass, and gotten to Three Forks some weeks, maybe even 2 months sooner. But they continued upstream on the Missouri, as Jefferson had ordered. On May 3rd, Lewis, walking on the north bank among vast quantities of game, came to a beautiful bowl.